The Senate Judiciary Budget Division come to order. Today is Tuesday, February 23rd, in the year 2010. And thank you for coming, folks. I think we're dealing with some very interesting materials. Hopefully we can make a dent in some of those. But good morning, afternoon, that is. And we're going to go through the our portion of the governor's supplemental budget bill. And we're also going to hear the testimony from the Board of Judicial Standards and the Board of Public Defense as to how these proposed cuts will impact on their services. I'd like to start out with this. We will bring forth Chris Turner, our staff man, and he'll go through the spreadsheet and detail cuts and changes proposed by the governor. Chris?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. I'll briefly go over the spreadsheet that's in front of you. Should be dated 2/22/9:17 p.m.
You have to speak up. I'm having trouble hearing.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm going to be going over the spreadsheet that's in your packet. Basically, in this budget, as well as his other budget areas, the governor's principles were 3%. He's going to have 3% budget reduction from the unspent 2010 base appropriation, and then 3% of the entire 2011 base appropriation. It comes out over the course of the biennium to be approximately a point, 0.25% or a quarter percent of a 2.5% of a cut off of the biennial base appropriation. So we'll start with the Supreme Court. Listed, the Supreme Court has a base budget of $62,751,000. The governor recommends a reduction of $1,476,000. Like I said, that's a cut of 2.4%.
When you're doing that, can you indicate the number of the sentence, if you will, when you go from one to
the line?
Yes, please.
Okay. Mr. Chairman, members, the budget reduction for the Supreme Court is on line 5. We have that results in a total Supreme Court operations new budget of $61,284,000. Move down to civil legal services. We have a base budget of $24,200,000. Governor recommends a reduction of $1,053,000. We move down to the Court of Appeals. Base budget of $20,570,000, reduction of on line 19 of $468,000. The district court, we have a base budget of $500,232,000. The governor recommends an operating reduction of $11,229,000. And then he also recommends the transfer of implied consent hearings from the district courts to the Office of Administrative Hearings. That would result in a cut to the court's base budget of $516,000, and that would result in a total court budget for fiscal years 10 and 11 of $488,487,000. Move on to the tax court, base budget of $1,636,000, recommended reduction of $37,000, total tax court budget of $1,599,000. Uniform Laws Commission, base budget $102,000. Governor recommends a reduction in the second year of $2,000. Board of Judicial Standards, base budget of $912,000. The governor recommends a budget reduction of $24,000 for a new base budget of, or general fund total of $888,000. If we move to the Public Defense Board, Public Defender has a base biennial budget of $132,056,000. The governor recommends a general reduction to the public defender of $2,376,000. In addition, he recommends a cut to the Public Defense Corporation grants of $913,000, for a total cut of $3,289,000. Total reductions in the budget are total $18,085,000. In this budget, there are no general fund transfers and there are no revenue items, and so we have just a straightforward general fund cut of $18,085,000. That's it, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Members have any questions? And hearing none, I move forward. Let's go to the Board of Judicial Standards. Mr. Paul, welcome to the committee.
Thank you.
Would you please identify yourself for the record?
I'm David Paul. I'm the Executive Secretary to the Board on Judicial Standards. I know that the Senate and the House are in a great deal of difficulty this year with the budget, and our budget, of course, is very small, but the work we do is very, very important. The board must move on cases when it gets them, and it never really knows what it's going to get. And what it's going to get is never really under its control. If we don't have enough money to do the cases, then we find ourselves in a position where we're depending on lawyers to advance us the costs and delay the fees, which is never a good situation. And
Mr. Paul, can you just focus on what goes on in your office before you get into the actual detail? In other words, you are involved in the disciplinary action, for instance, and tell us that, plus what kind of funding sources that you have.
Right now we are involved in three major cases, and this is a little unusual for us. Usually, if we have one at all, we have just one in any particular fiscal year. This year we have three. I think my handout is there. It shows the allocation of the special fund that we have, the revolving fund that we have for attorney's fees and for attorney's costs, case costs, such as court reporters, witness fees, that type of thing. Right now we have allocated case number one. If you look on the second page, it's a disability case. These are the largest cases we can have because we have to pay not one attorney but two under the rules. And this is one that is just beginning. The last disability case extended over 3 years, as most of our cases extend over 3 years, and it cost us about $247,000. The last non-disability case that we had was, again, over a three-year period, cost $186,000. The second case is a pure misconduct case that does not involve any kind of disability, any kind of medical or mental claim. And this case is in the last stages of completion. Again, it's been a very, very tough road for us because sometimes it's difficult to get information. The third case is a newer case. We've retained an attorney, and the probability we feel of it going to hearing is over 50%. And there is a fourth one. We're not counting right now, but the judge will make his decision this week whether or not he'll go to hearing. So we'll know by Friday, but we don't know at this point. We finance all these things through a revolving fund, which is $125,000 per year. We have in our operating budget we have a Category 4 investigation before the cases are referred to an attorney, and that is $28,000 right now per year, and we already have most of it committed, and it's still six months to go, basically, five months to go until the end of the fiscal year. So we have four attorneys retained. We have four cases in the active fees, in the active stage. Investigation fees have been $15,000 for 6 months. We have $28,000 for the entire year. We've been trying to save money where we can. We conduct most evaluations now by telephone only as opposed to traveling statewide, which is more expensive. Sometimes we can't avoid it, but usually we can. We're looking at a three-year period, as I said, for these hearings, and we can give you what we have now, but we never know what's down the road. So we're hopeful that no cut would be necessary, but if it is, it would be as minimally as it can be done. Questions, if there are any.
Any member have a question? Senator Betzel.
Mr. Chairman, the investigations, who conducts these investigations?
Well, Senator Betzel, before we retain an attorney, we hire private investigators, and we hire them directly now. This is one of the changes that have come with our revolving fund. Now we can hire the investigators directly, and we can negotiate directly with them. Therefore, we know we have hourly savings on those rates, so we're happy with that. And then after the case gets to the attorney stage, the attorneys usually like to conduct some kind of investigation on their own, because they can interact directly with the witnesses.
Senator Betts.
Who are these investigators? Are they private eyes? Are they FBI agents?
Actually, depending on your timing, they're both. I mean, they are, in fact, former FBI agents who are retired and now who investigate not only for us but for others also.
Mr. Paul, can you just kind of take us through this thing from the day you receive a complaint to the day some action is made, and then ultimately who pays for this and what the basis is? Because you're paying back after the fact, are you not?
Yes. Generally speaking, we would get a complaint. I evaluate it to determine whether or not there are any allegations in it that our board can consider. Of course, the board is limited in its scope in that it cannot and would not even pretend to consider anything related to the merits of a case. These, of course, are issues for the court, not for a state agency. But we do focus on the personal conduct of judges and judicial officers. If the evaluation reveals that there are allegations that the board can investigate, then I go ahead and investigate them. It's not really an investigation. It's more of an evaluation. I call the witnesses. Sometimes I go see them, rarely. And then I inspect documents, and I report in a summary to the board. The board, at that point, has the opportunity to determine whether it wants to proceed further or not. And if it doesn't proceed further, then it dismisses. If it does proceed further, then it usually notifies the judge that, or the judicial officer, that a complaint has been received, and sends the complaint to him or her and asks for their comments on it to get information. Then the board goes back and reconsiders. At that point, the judge or judicial officer has a chance to appear before the board before a decision is made. If that takes place, it's done at the next meeting, and then the board makes a decision depending on the type of this discipline or no discipline made. There, it is a possibility for the judge to appear one more time. And at that point, the board is in a position to suggest discipline to the judge or judicial officer. And all it is a suggestion. It has no power to impose it by itself without the consent of the judge. At that point, the judge hears the discipline, what the proposal is, and decides whether or not the judge wants to challenge it or not. If he challenges it or she challenges it, then it goes into the public arena, and both sides usually get attorneys at that point. And that at that point is when the revolving fund is usually used, because that is reserved for attorney's fees, court costs such as court reporters, and additional investigation at that point. So it's not until that point that those funds get used. And of course, we have 1,600 contacts in a year right now, and we usually only get one case, but we have four right now, which is a little unusual. But the number of contacts has been the same. It's just kind of the luck of the draw this year.
Thank you, Mr. Paul. Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Paul, when it comes to the point where the judge needs an attorney, does the cost of retaining the attorney come out of your budget for the judge?
Thank you, Senator. Those costs come out of the budget only if it is a disability case. If it is a pure misconduct case without a mental or physical element in it, health element in it, then the judge is obligated to retain his or her own attorney.
Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Oh, well, thank you, Chair. And my second question is, when I look at the activity discipline cases, number one here, two attorneys retained the cost of nearly $250,000. The cost I'm probably not so concerned about, but what means, you know, I'm thinking, what would one of my constituents ask, and they would ask a simple question, what would it possibly take 3 years to resolve that?
Mr. Paul?
I'm sorry. Through the chair, that is a good question. It does take that long when you consider that the board meets about every month, and there are all these procedures that we have to observe. It usually takes 1 month for me to evaluate. It usually takes a month for the board to decide whether or not it wants to notify the judge. It usually takes another month for the judge to get back to us. And sometimes that can take 2 months, because under the rules, the judge has 30 days to respond. And that may not match up exactly with the meeting. So right away, that could go over a meeting, and then it could take 2 months because we wouldn't be able to get to it until the second meeting. And then sometimes the board, then there are the two visits. They would have to take place on two separate months. And then somewhere in there, the board's going to have to make a determination whether to dismiss or to go forward. So right there, without any...
Almost 3/4 of the year.
Just on a dismissal. No, it wouldn't be 3/4. I think on a dismissal, it'd probably be around 5 months or 6 months, depending on what the judge decides. But after that, it's 3 or 4 more months before we get straightened around, and then we usually get the... We have a negotiation period sometimes where we negotiate discipline. And usually, of course, the board and the judicial officer agree on discipline. That's 98% of the time. But when it doesn't, it gets into money for us.
Yeah. Thank you. Senator Betzel.
If the judge is requesting disability, and all the evidence you've got indicates disability, should it take, you know, does it take this long, you know, if it's clear that the judge is disabled, or does it go on to stretch it out?
Not normally. But there are cases in which the board disputes the evidence itself. In other words, it may think, well, this does not look to be like a disability. Sometimes the tables are reversed, where the judge feels there's no disability, but the board feels there is one. It's not a kind of thing where it's just the same thing happening all the time. So, you know, the rules provide, and I know you know this very well because you work so hard on them, the rules provide that the board must make an objective investigation to determine whether or not there's reasonable cause to believe there's a disability, and that's regardless of who contends what. And so that sometimes that is the case, not always. Usually, again, it's fairly clear what the path forward is, but not always.
Any further questions? Is there anyone in the audience that wishes to speak on this?
Yeah, I would.
Just come up to the table.
Is that a question for me, or am I?
Yes, it would be a question for you.
Am I supposed to ask a question or speak?
You can just speak.
Yeah. Tim Kinley, and I'm me, been involved in judicial reform. The one glaring problem, I think, yeah, we need to have judicial oversight, but the one glaring problem is this is under the judiciary and not under the legislature, which the people in their constitution have said that's where it belongs. Article 6, Section 9, Article 8. So my objection to this is it's not constitutional to fund the Board on Judicial Standards, and the legislature needs to establish the discipline process. The other concern I have, the legislature needs to establish the discipline process through the legislature, in the legislature. And then the other problem I have is this is not a very transparent organization in the way it is structured. And it's very difficult to find out who's being disciplined, what they're being disciplined for, the allegations and the complaints that are being brought up against judges. I mean, you're legislators. You're a political branch. The judicial is a political branch, too, because it's one of the three branches of government. And we need transparency, and we're not getting transparency. The people are not finding out what judges are doing. And as a legislator, you have allegations coming against you all the time. I mean, you're used to that. The day before the election, something will come out in the paper. And I know that's a concern of the Board on Judicial Standards. If we have transparency, then somebody might make a false allegation. Welcome to the real world. And I personally, my personal belief is we have a very corrupt judiciary. And they're getting away with a lot of crimes. And, you know, I know David Paul is doing what he can do, but the system doesn't allow true transparency. And so, you know, it needs to be funded, but not the Board on Judicial Standards and the judiciary. We need the transparency, we need the blue sky, and we need the openness so the people can decide what are our judges doing and how are they doing it and what's taking place.
Thank you for your information.
Appreciate it. Can I respond to just one point of that?
Proceed.
I just want to point out that the witness mentioned that we are in the legislature. That is not quite accurate. We are, in fact, an independent agency that's not under any branch directly. The legislature funds us. The Supreme Court approves our rules. The executive appoints the members of our board. So we're really not under any particular branch of government, but we are a true independent agency.
Thank you.
And Mr. Chair.
Mr. Chair,
and the Senate does confirm gubernatorial appointments to the board, too. So there is some oversight. Mr. Chair, I do dispute some of the things the witness said. However, I've had a criticism of the board over the years about some secrecy. And, in fact, it's some judges. You know, they sometimes complain that there's, you know, complaints being filed. They you know, files are open, files are closed, and they don't get the whole word. Now, it's sometimes because, you know, we don't want the judges to be biased against people who brought complaints, but sometimes judges are even in the dark as to what's really going on there. And so I think there's I do agree that there's probably too much secrecy that goes on with this board.
Thank you, Senator. We're going to move on. This hearing is really not geared for that. It's a financial hearing, so we stay with that. We're prepared to go forward on the Board of Public Defense. Mr. Kyer.
Mr. Chairman, members, for the record, my name is Kevin Kyer. I'm the Chief Administrator with the Board of Public Defense. In your packet, you should all have a presentation that we put together on the budget. But I want to refer you back to the spreadsheet for just a moment that Mr. Turner went through. On lines 51 and through 53, I think that he mentioned a 6% cut to the Public Defense Corporation grants. The proposal that the governor has is actually a 6% reduction on all grant funding, which includes the majority, the vast majority of which is what we provide to Hennepin and Ramsey counties to run those public defender systems. If you all recall, all of the existing staff in those two offices prior to January 1st of 1990 remain county employees. So they remain on the payroll there. So in a sense, what's happened is we actually have kind of a double hit here. And if you look at the percentages, it actually elevates the percentage reduction the governor's talking to about 4% rather than the 3%, because by and large that is direct service to clients. So I did want to at least make that one clarification. There's a lot of information in this handout. I'm not going to go through it all with you, but I would like to start just by referring you to page 3. As most of you know, this fall, I guess it was, early winter, the Supreme Court approved a $75 lawyer registration fee increase dedicated to public defense. In addition, we were granted some federal funding. If nothing happens this legislative session, the board is slated to lose $4.3 million in the 2012 and 13 biennium. The $75 fee has been a one-time fee. At least at this point, the Supreme Court's indicated it was a 4-3 vote on that particular fee increase. I don't know if you saw Justice Anderson's opinion on that, but he was fairly adamant that he's not voting for another one, and was, frankly, I think a little irritated that he had to vote for this one. So, in addition, as I mentioned, the governor's recommendation is an additional 4% reduction. Last year, as I sat here, we talked about the reductions in staffing that we made earlier. We had about a 14% reduction in our attorney staff about a year and a half ago now, almost 2 years. With the governor's recommendation, we are looking at somewhere between another 10 and 15% reduction in attorney staff. There's just no place for us to go with these kinds of reductions. Page 5 of your handout shows the general fund recommendations with the governor's recommendation. You can see we started out fiscal year 2009 at just over $69 million. We'll be down to about 63 or just over $63 million by the end of 2011. Again, as I mentioned, we don't have a lot of wiggle room in this budget. If you look at page 7, about 90% of the budget is personnel. If you throw in things like mileage and some of the other contractual obligations, it raises to about 95%. So there really is not a lot of places we can go with this. If you read the legislative auditor's report, I think what the auditors had to say was the last time we went through this with the reductions we went through, they found it to be a reasonable approach to doing this. We lost 53 positions, attorney positions, last time around. Not all of them by layoff, but certainly through attrition and by not filling some staff, and by layoffs, by voluntary separation programs, all of those things. At that time, as you recall, and the issue is still pending in front of the Supreme Court, we got out of the business of representing parents in child protection cases. There's still a question as to whether or not we get that service back or not. That was a non-required service. I'm here to tell you today that we are all out of those services. There is nothing now that we're doing that isn't either constitutionally or statutorily mandated. So at this point, the question becomes, what do we do with another 10 or 15% loss in staffing? The other concern that we have, frankly, is personnel costs over the next two-year period, 2012 and 13. As you all know and are struggling with, health insurance costs are going up. Our employees settled for a hard salary freeze this two-year period. No step increases, no cost of living adjustments. I'm not sure they're going to be willing to do that again, or we're going to be able to achieve that again. If, in fact, that happens, some increase in those costs with the health insurance costs, we potentially could be looking at up to a third of our staff being let go over the next two-and-a-half-year period. It's not implausible. What this means in terms of kind of where we're at with caseloads, with workloads, you can see we get to it on pages 14 and 15. On page 15, you can see our case units. Our weighted caseload standards calls for an attorney to handle no more than 400 case units per year, roughly the equivalent of a misdemeanor. Right now, with the staffing we have, we're at about 767 case units on average statewide. Given what we know, we will go probably up to that 903, and with those personnel cost increases that we're talking about, we could be as high as 961, so we're going to be approaching 1,000 case units. To put this in perspective, we have a number of private lawyers that obviously we have relationships with. A couple of them who do a lot of private criminal work will tell you that if they open 70 files, now that's a mixed group of files, felonies, gross misdemeanors, and misdemeanors. If they open or handle 70 cases in a year, that's a full-time job for them. That's a lot of work for them. Our folks right now are probably close to triple, if not four times that, in terms of the number of cases that they're opening. What does it mean in terms of time? Right now, we're at just under 4 hours per case. And that may seem like a lot, but again, remember that includes all case types. Felonies, gross misdemeanors, juvenile cases. We are looking at probably going down to 3 hours per case. That includes all of the time, interviewing the client, reading the file, waiting in court, frankly, in greater Minnesota, travel time. Can you imagine if you were accused of a felony and your lawyer said, I can meet with you, I can represent you, but you only got 3 hours? With the loss of the one-time funding, the 4% reduction, and the personnel costs, we're looking at that maybe go down to right around 2.5 hours per case. Again, I go back to a private case that I'm somewhat familiar with. It was a felony. It's a fairly serious felony case. The private lawyer came to this person's house and spent 6 hours with an initial interview before he even was retained by that person. 6 hours just to interview that client. That's before he even read the complaint. It's before he even was retained, before he even started to appear in court. Those are the kinds of things that we're dealing with, that our folks are dealing with out there. As you might imagine, the stress level is unbelievable for those folks. There's pressure to move cases along. There's people that are interviewing people out in the hallway for the first time. I know some of you have been in court. You've seen some of those things. Frankly, I don't know where we go. We have discussed the option of not taking any more or out of custody cases. That, as you noted in one of the slides, I forgot which one it is, the board's priorities, which we used the last time, was in custody cases and providing service there. It may be that that's all we can do, is providing service to those in custody clients. If you're out of custody, that will have to wait until a later date. There will be counties in greater Minnesota that are not going to have a public defender. For example, in Mankato right now, I think we service 3 or 4 counties. It may be that we end up servicing 6 counties out of Mankato, which means that we're not going to be able to be everywhere. So are there some severe ramifications in terms of the judicial system and how that's going to operate in the long run? Again, this last slide tells you a little bit about some of the issues that we're facing just in terms of costs. I'm here to tell you, I guess it's nothing new that we haven't talked about before, except it is getting more and more dire out there. So, Mr. Chairman, with that, I'm happy to stand for any questions or comments, or I wish I had some ideas for you. We're fresh out.
members, questions, comments? Senator Ingebrigtsen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that report. And I'm just looking for a feel in regard to counties. Both in metro and rural, and is there a feeling there that, I mean, this is real, getting down to me, it seems to be over beyond crunch time now for the judiciary here, and I'm wondering, what's the feeling with your folks with regard to what's happening at the state level versus the county level? Is that a fair question? Or?
Mr. Clare.
Do you think the counties are doing their part here? Do you think they're...
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ingebrigtsen. Let me answer it this way. I think that there is at times a disconnect, and I'll give you an example. But I'll preface by saying, you know, we're part of the Judicial Coalition, the Coalition to Preserve the Judiciary. We have county people on there. We have, obviously, the Chief Justice who's been leading the charge. We have sheriffs. We have the police. We have the county attorneys. We have the city attorneys. But let me give you an example. I have two emails in the last 3 days from a county in southern Minnesota where they're charging parking violations as misdemeanors. So in other words, you are now entitled to a lawyer, you are entitled to a trial, you have 90 days in jail hanging over your head. We have another one where we went to trial on a case of noxious weeds. Now, noxious weeds may be very important in some parts of the state. But is it really worth 90 days in jail? I use those because I'm not sure that we, as a collective, county, state, the legislature, the executive branch, the judiciary, for that matter, have sat down and said, what are our priorities going to be? Because you all are struggling with funding. We're struggling with it. The court is certainly struggling with it. I know the counties are struggling with it. But nobody's been willing to talk about what are we going to do about the inputs? What are we going to do about prioritizing what comes into the system? Because it's not just about us. I mean, we're a bigger player in it. But it is. It's the prosecutors. Well, it's the police. Start with them. It's the police. It's the prosecutors, the public defenders, the courts, probation. All of those folks are under that same pressure. And nobody's been willing to say, here are our priorities. And I think you got a little bit of that with the legislative auditor's report. I think they mentioned that in there as well. Mm-hmm. So, and until we all do, I'm not sure what we're going to do.
Further questions? I don't offer you any great wisdom. I'd have to say, Mr. Kyer, that it's been a pleasure to work with you, and want you to know that I do see some serious implications of this, and that if we do not reach some kind of fit things together, why we're certainly keeping just going downhill, really. And I think that I'm not really prepared to accept the excuse that we're stuck with no action, which leaves us courtrooms without public defenders, that leave inadequate coverage in areas. How many hours, how many days are we going to force a public defender to take action in, let's say, greater Minnesota, where the allegation has been that somehow or another that we can just, you know, cut off, lay somebody off. Yeah, we're going to do that with some judges, and it's not going to be any pleasure for them or for us. And I thank you for what you're doing. Senator Betzel.
Mr. Kyer, you know, of course, in this budget division, we see the public defender's budget, and you know, we know how dire it is. We see the court's budget, and we're told, you know, the courts are under pressure because, you know, there's fewer judges, the caseloads keep mounting. I don't have a sense
from one of the players, like the county attorneys. Do you sense that there's any cutbacks there? Are they growing? Because you don't control the business that comes in. Every time they file a complaint, you get it.
Right.
And if they keep building up their empire and their investigators and everything like that, there's a disconnect here because there's more business coming in the door for everybody. What do you see? Because we don't see that as part of our
area. Mr. Chairman, Senator Betzel, I think that you saw some of that over the last, 10 years. I mean, you all are under pressure from folks about talking about public safety and getting tough on crime. Obviously, those county boards are feeling that same kind of political pressure, if you will. My sense is, and it's just a sense, and just talking to some of our coalition members and some of the folk county attorney folks is, there are a number of places where, at a minimum, they're holding positions open. Or they're losing folks through attrition or some of those things. I don't hear a lot of them, where they're adding people. But, relative to public defenders, I will tell you there are more prosecutors in this state than there are public defenders. There's no question about that. And I'm not saying there are too many, don't get me wrong, but there are more of them. But I don't think there's any county, or it doesn't seem like there's a lot of counties out there that are adding a lot of folks to the prosecutorial roles. Could be wrong, but
and Mr. Chair, of course the county attorneys are basically funded by the counties. The Attorney General's office does provide assistance to most of the counties in the state for major crimes. Obviously, we don't really, but the small counties do. But I do get the sense, for instance, the Attorney General's office also scaling back on some of the assistance they're providing out there, whether it's on some of the cases that they're going to take or represent or appeal. So I think there is, there is a falling apart of the system all over the place. And I mean, you're obviously an example of one of the areas that is happening all over. Maybe less so on the prosecutorial side. Thank you.
Further questions? Comments? I guess I don't have anything more to say. Thank you, Mr.
Thank
Kier.
You.
Appreciate it. We have completed the committee meeting, and the committee is adjourned.